Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
What could you do if your data was working for you and not against you? With Bloomberg delivering enterprise data directly to your systems, you get easy access to the details you want, optimized for higher level analysis, and financial data experts committed to helping you maximize your every move. Our data is made for more, so you can show the world what you're made of. Visit Bloomberg.com/enterprise data to learn more.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovec from Bloomberg Radio.
Well, tomorrow will mark the beginning of the third year of the Russian invasion and war with Ukraine, on this cusp of another year of war, potentially between the two, likely between the two. The U.S. unveiling its biggest one-day sanctions package, against Russia since the invasion of Ukraine. They targeted more than 500 people and entities. It's a fresh bid to squeeze the country's economy, the Russian economy, and send a message over the death of dissident Alexei Navalny.
Here's U.S. Treasury's Deputy Secretary Wally Adeyemi addressing the new sanctions earlier on Bloomberg Surveillance.
Important to remember that our objective remains the same, going after Russia's military-industrialized complex and their ability to earn money to prop up their economy and buy the goods they need to fight the war they want. What we're doing today is we are furthering those actions by going after companies in Russia that are helping to build military equipment.
That's U.S. Treasury Deputy Secretary Wally Adeyemi earlier on Bloomberg. To understand the strategy and endgame of Russia and for President Putin, Carol, let's get to the interview.
Yep, back with us, a favorite informed voice on Russia and President Putin, Angela Stent, senior fellow at Brookings Institution, author of Putin's World, Russia Against the West and With the Rest, a former national intelligence officer for Russia and Eurasia at the National Intelligence Council, also served in the Office of Policy Planning at the U.S. State Department. This is why she's a favorite voice to go to. She's in Washington, D.C. Angela, welcome back. I have loved our conversations over the past 2 years, but I have been sad that we've had to keep having them because the war continues on. Here we are about to mark the third year of war. Are the sanctions, these latest sanctions by the United States, in your view, largely symbolic and unlikely to impact the Russia and its crusade against Ukraine?
Well, we'll have to see. So far, all of the sanctions that were imposed by the U.S. and its allies, they've certainly dented the Russian economy to some extent, but they haven't changed Putin's course. And right now, Putin thinks that Russia is winning. He appears to be very self-confident. So we have sanctioned industries that are feeding the military-industrial complex. We've sanctioned individuals. We're still trying to go after energy companies and Russia's energy exports and trying to persuade those who are helping Russia to evade those energy sanctions, in fact, to implement them. But a lot of this, I fear, is symbolic. I mean, we've sanctioned the people who were involved in Navalny's death in the prison camp where he was, but they're not likely to want to come to the United States, nor do I think that they have any bank accounts here. So I think there could be more that we would be doing and that we haven't done, and that is taking the frozen Russian assets, or at least the interest on them, and using that to help support Ukraine. And we could do more in the energy realm. It's unfortunate that the Biden administration now says that U.S. LNG exports should cease after a few years, when we should be exporting more LNG, say, to Europe, so that they don't keep importing Russian LNG.
Why do you think the sanctions have been so ineffective at crippling Russia's economy? Because over the last 2 years, Dr. Stent, we have a lot of people on our program who said, you know, especially at the beginning of the war, given the sanctions that the U.S. and a lot of the West is putting on the country, the economy is going to be taken to its knees. And that absolutely has not happened over the last 2 years.
It hasn't happened because what Russia has done is it's taken its economy to a war footing. So it's now really a war economy. And the defense industries are working overtime. Russia had a GDP growth rate last year of 0.3%, which was higher than anyone thought and higher than a lot of European countries, given the situation that we're in. So I think we have miscalculated the Russians' ability to deal with these sanctions. And then I have to say, you know, there's a lot of sanctions evasion. A number of countries are helping Russia evade these sanctions, including some of its neighbors in Central Asia. We know the Chinese are to some extent. So it's very hard for these kind of sanctions to succeed if you don't have really global agreement on them. And it's really only the US and its European and Asian allies that have been implementing these sanctions.
Angela, will we be having a different conversation if China was more on the side of Europe and the United States in this?
I think we might, because even though the President Xi Jinping warned Putin about the use of nuclear weapons, and we haven't heard Putin talk about that for a long time, although some of his colleagues have, the Chinese, they're not really neutral in this. I mean, they are exporting components to the Russians that are being used in weapons and for other industrial uses. They haven't really put any pressure on the Russians to wind down this war. And even though they attended a couple of the first meetings with a number of different countries about the Ukrainian peace plan, they did not attend the meeting in Davos or the one that was held in December. So I would say that they have neutrality but leaning toward Russia. And Xi Jinping just said again, you know, how great the relationship was. So I think if the Chinese had acted differently, it wouldn't have been as easy for the Russians to be at the point where they are now.
Angela, we saw Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer make a surprise visit to Ukraine, in a big part, to try to reassure Volodymyr Zelensky that the U.S. will make good on its next round of aid, even though it faces obstacles in Congress. What would your message be to lawmakers right now who oppose an aid package to Ukraine?
I think the message to them is, if we do not send the $60 billion to Ukraine and more weapons, the kind of sophisticated weapons they need, it's going to be very hard for them to prevail against Russia. And I think these people have to think, do you really want Russia to win this war? Do you know what it might mean going forward? It will then reinforce the aggressive tendencies of the Russian regime. And that does not make the U.S. any safer. It certainly makes our allies a lot less safe. And do we want to be drawn back into a broader European conflict as we were twice in the 20th century? I think those are the kinds of things they should think about. And also that a lot of this money that we would be allocating to Ukraine goes to U.S. defense companies. So it's money that's being earned and staying in America.
Ukrainian President Zelensky is pressing for NATO membership. Many say that that's unlikely before this war ends. But I do think about the risk in this now third year, whether or not Ukraine gets just enough support to continue, fighting and resisting, but not sufficient enough to defeat Russia. And ultimately, that's how it plays out. Do you have any idea, or I don't know, how you see maybe what happens here in this third year?
So I think in this third year, the war will continue. Putin is waiting to see what happens in our elections in November. And he's hoping that if President Trump is reelected, then the U.S. will cease supporting Ukraine. And so it'll be over and Russia will win. I think that we really need to think very carefully about what we're doing going forward in terms of supporting Ukraine. And as it is, even if that $60 billion does go to Ukraine,
right,
as you said, it will be enough for the Ukrainians to continue to push back, but not to win.
Ultimately, and I think about the nuclear ambitions. We talked about it a little bit earlier this week. I believe President Putin, he denied it, that wasn't his intentions. Do you think that that's potentially, in terms of Russia's nuclear ambitions, a real threat of something being put up in space against the United States and others?
I mean, it's possible. It's, of course, against the treaties that we have signed with the Russians and other countries, too. I wouldn't put it past him. I think at the moment, he wants us to believe that he might do it and to deter us from doing certain things. I mean, the main aim at the moment is just to spread fear, both in Russia's neighbors and in the West, about what Russia might do. But I think we have to watch this very carefully, and obviously our intelligence agencies are doing that.
Do you think that's working, that he's successfully spreading fear about what Russia is doing and what Russia could do?
He certainly had succeeded in some European countries, in some of Russia's neighbors. And I think there are people in the United States as well who think, we're so concerned about what Russia will do, we have to be careful. And I think the White House has been deterred from sending some weapons to Ukraine, which could hit really into the heart of Russia, because they do fear escalation, not necessarily the space escalation, but certainly escalation that could go to the potential use of a tactical nuclear weapon.
Angela, 30 seconds left here. If President Putin and Russia succeed for a second time here in Ukraine, what's the next target? Because I would assume there will be another one, or is that wrong? And just quickly.
I think ultimately there's another one, but I think not immediately, because clearly the Russian armed forces would have to regroup and refurbish themselves. It could be the Baltic states, one of the Baltic states, which did used to be part of the Soviet Union. And that's what, Putin has lamented, the collapse of the Soviet Union, or potentially Poland. That's certainly what the Poles think.
All right, going to leave it there. As always, so much appreciation, Angela. Dr. Angela Stent joining us there in Washington. As we said, author of Putin's World, Russia Against the West and With the Rest. She's a senior fellow at Brookings Institution, former national intelligence officer for Russia and Eurasia at the National Intelligence Council. Just a great voice when it comes to what's going on and trying to figure out what's next.
It's just hard to believe that we're already going to be in year three starting tomorrow.
How many times have we said, do you think it's another 6 months? Do we think it's another year? And here we are, starting the third year.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern. Listen on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
Well, one of our most read stories on the Bloomberg today is about a Fidelity International money manager that dumped nearly all of his positions in U.S. Treasuries from funds he oversees. His expectations are that the world's biggest economy, the U.S. economy, still has room to expand. Check it out. It's a great read on the Bloomberg terminal and at Bloomberg.com. It's just kind of one of the resets we continue to see, Tim.
Yeah, on that reset, I want to bring in Maddie Dessner, head of Global Asset Class Services at Capital Group. Its global investment and management organization manages more than $2.5 trillion. Maddie joining us from Los Angeles right now. Maddie, good to have you with us. The reason you're on is because Capital Group is out with its 20-year capital markets assumptions report. it sets out some pretty clear expectations about where you all at Capital Group think the market is going. And when we say market, we're talking macroeconomics, equities, fixed income, and FX market performance over the next 20 years. Carol and I were talking about this.
How do you do this?
Yeah, I mean, how clear is your crystal ball to be able to help us understand what U.S. equity markets are going to do over the next 20 years and what emerging market equities are going to do over the next 20 years?
Well, it's a great question, Tim and Carol, and thanks so much for having me on. You know, when we think about the long term, you have to consider what is directional, what you know is about to occur, and then what you can assume for the long term. So really what our expectations are inputs to ensure that our clients are set up for success for the long term. And our expectation as we look forward is that they are actually our broad expectation for a 60-40 portfolio is about 6% annualized over 20 years. And when we look through the asset classes, we've changed things a bit as we've seen action in the markets over the last couple of years. We've actually brought down our equity assumptions just by a bit, about 6.9% for U.S. equities, given the valuation change that we saw over the last year. Not extreme, but our expectations are that valuations are a little less attractive. And then for fixed income, we've actually brought up our expectations. You're seeing some equity-like returns out of fixed income sectors, particularly some of those extended sectors. So we really feel good about the puts and takes of the long-term expectations and the fact that investors will be set up for success as long as they stay invested.
All right. How do you figure it out? Like we said, your crystal ball. But what are these assumptions based on? I'm always interested in how do you make the sausage here in terms of investing. So what is it that these are based on in terms of kind of reducing your equity assumptions over the next 20 years, but maybe raising your fixed income assumptions?
Yeah, so we actually decompose the returns into building blocks. So as you start to pick apart the pieces, you can think about what will change in those building blocks. So we think about economic growth. Mm-hmm. What does that look like over the next 20 years? Productivity. What happens to the labor force? Inputs into demographics, how that picture will change over the next 20 years. These are knowable things. Our expectation of changing technology and the productivity of the workforce, we think that has a big impact on the expectations. And then, of course, currency. Certainly for U.S.-based investors of international assets, both developed as well as emerging, our expectations for the dollar and other currencies, how that impact the supply-demand dynamics and the balance of trade. And then, of course, the expectation of the change in share count. There's been quite a lot of buybacks, and that has changed the expectation for earnings for companies, for individual shareholders. And then the last thing is yield. Both on the fixed income and the equity side, our expectation is that you're going to start to see healthier dividend yields, particularly in the international space, less so in the U.S. And that, as I said before, starting yields in fixed income are much higher. So as we look at each of these building blocks, we sort of build up the elements from the bottoms up perspective and then look top down and ask ourselves, how realistic are these numbers?
Hey, Maddie, I want to dig into the equities research that you and the team over at Capital Group have done, because I was pretty surprised to see that over the next 20 years, you expect emerging market equities to outperform U.S. equities pretty significantly, and that surprised me, given the outperformance we've seen from U.S. equities over the last 10, 15 years at this point.
Yeah, our expectation is that there are both cyclical and secular changes going on in emerging markets. So if we just frankly look at the inflation picture within emerging markets, inflation accelerated early on, central banks started to ease or tighten pretty quickly, and now they're in the path of easing policy. So they're a bit ahead of us in that cycle. We expect to see an upturn from that perspective. There's certainly a benefit from a continued weakness of the dollar, which we expect to see over the long term. And then one of the most important things about emerging markets is the change in supply chains that we expect to see over the long term. So we know that Chinese growth is slowing due to demographic impacts as well as less than friendly market reforms. But what's happening is companies are starting to remove their supply chain exposure to China and going to places like India, like Mexico, like Southeast Asia. So we really do expect a resumption of manufacturing centers in those areas. And then the last thing I'll point to is that from an emerging markets perspective, the demographic picture, the age of the workforce looks a lot healthier than in some other areas of the world.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I'm also curious, you know, here we are coming off a week where we were all agog over NVIDIA, right? Its results, its outlook, its impact on the trade continues to play out today. You guys did look at, as one of your key criteria, the changing technology on workforce. Talk to us a little bit about what's the changing technology that you focused on and its impact.
Yeah, it's a number of things, Carol. It's not just one. Mm-hmm. If we think about the impact of, you know, how productive is every single worker? If everybody was doing the same jobs that they did in 1950 versus today, how much more can they build? How many more patients can they see? How long is the expectations for life expectancy and how that's changing? So things like artificial intelligence and how that's helping us do our jobs, cloud computing and how that's helping us be more efficient, and even some of the innovations in healthcare, whether it's gene therapies or immunizations, these will impact our longevity and frankly our health as a nation and as a world society. So all of these things are incorporated together to, from our perspective, significantly increase the productivity of each hour worked from individuals. So it's a bit of a give back to the giveaway that we have from demographics, because we know that this is an aging nation.
Right.
We're aging all over the world, and that will impact.
We talk about that a lot here on the program. Maddie, we only have 30 seconds left, but we got to talk politics and how you factor politics into your analysis here, not just here in the US, but around the world. Just 30 seconds left.
Yeah, exogenous factors, hard to incorporate into the actual analysis. So we really do try to look through that and think long term. From our perspective, though, as we look at the last 23 election cycles, mm-hmm. what we notice is that markets trend up on average every single time. There's lots of volatility around the primary environment. But once we have, regardless of who sits in the administrative chairs, we tend to see up markets in that election cycle more so than in non-election years. So we're pretty constructive.
All right. Really appreciate this and look forward. Hopefully we can get you back real soon. Maddie Desner, she's head of global asset class services over at Capital Group, a global investment management group managing more than $2.5 trillion. Maddie, of course, joining us from Los Angeles.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Listen live each weekday starting at 2 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
All right, well, the U.S. Bitcoin ETFs that debuted back on January 11th and the Grayscale Bitcoin Trust that converted into an ETF that same day have, as of Tuesday, brought in about a net $5 billion of investor inflow so far. So money coming in, Tim.
Yeah, that's real money. The anticipation and rollout of the products, by the way, stoking a doubling in Bitcoin's price over the past 12 months. For more on the space and the opportunities that he sees, let's bring in Dave Donnelly, Managing Director at Spider Rock Advisors. It's a Chicago-based asset management firm that specializes in their own words, providing customized option overlay strategies to investors. By the way, they've got about $4.5 billion in assets under management. Dave, good to have you with us for our weekly crypto segment this afternoon. You don't have a spot Bitcoin ETF. Rather, you were going to introduce an options overlay strategy on the ETF. Explain what exactly this is for people who aren't familiar with the strategy and what that gives for clients.
Sure. Thanks for having me. Really, a couple thoughts here. You know, you've got, as you just stated, billions of dollars in inflows into these ETFs. We're not an ETF manufacturer. Instead, we're an advisor who tries to help intermediaries and clients hedge the existing positions that they have. So, you know, while you've got $5 billion or so in these ETFs already, you've got $1 trillion worth of Bitcoin out there owned in the more traditional way, you know, with hot wallets and cold storage. You know, we think these ETFs make it so much easier for normal investors to access these products and get something to track the price of Bitcoin. But here's the benefit. They can now hold it in a securities account. And at some point very soon, these ETFs are going to have listed options on them, which allows us to do our work, you know, whether it's single stock positions or indexes or now spot Bitcoin ETFs. Our focus is helping folks hedge those existing positions in their brokerage account, in an advisory account, helping to manage the risk in a customized way. Options on Bitcoin ETFs are going to be the gateway to doing that. Interestingly, not only on the ETFs that people own, but there are ways to do it on the Bitcoin they own elsewhere and do that from their securities account.
Got to say, Dave, one of the things we love to ask, it's a simple question. Why are you doing this? And we're just curious if your clients and the investors or the clients that you guys help have been asking for something like this.
100%. Everything we do is really driven by client demand. We hold ourselves out to be able to do our best to help clients hedge, you know, whatever they own in the public security space. So we've gotten a lot of asks about this over the years and haven't been able to do anything. Obviously, trading Bitcoin or unlisted Bitcoin options isn't something that's readily available in your brokerage or advisory account. So the proliferation of these spot ETFs, and you know, we've been in contact with SIBO, who's working with regulators to get the options on those spot ETFs available. That's new, and that is going to open the door to being able to help folks hedge. Obviously, a highly volatile instrument. Some folks enjoy that for trading. A lot of people have just made a lot of money in it, and just like you'd want to hedge anything where you had significant gains but don't necessarily want to sell and pay taxes on it, that's where our business comes in to help folks hedge, and we're really excited to be able to do that with relation to Bitcoin now.
When do you think you'll be able to actually do that? Like, what's the ETA?
Last date I heard is that there's some regulatory going on in mid-March, so it could be by the end of Q1, but we're basically just waiting to get those options listed, make sure that there's enough liquidity available, and we'll be ready to go to work.
I just want to say, when it comes to regulators and cryptocurrency, specifically Bitcoin, it's been a waiting game, Dave. So are you being realistic, do you think, in those expectations?
Unequivocally, it has been a waiting game. I think, you know, the decision that was made to allow the spot Bitcoin ETF was sort of the biggest decision that had to be made. I have heard nothing from the exchanges we're speaking with that make it sound like it's going to be anywhere near as protracted a time period for the options as that was.
So I am also curious how the strategy is actually going to work, and in terms of mitigating the volatility that we have seen with the spot, you know, spot Bitcoin over the last couple of years. So how does it work specifically?
Sure. I think the most sort of typical approach to reducing risk for a client is just simply a costless collar. In this strategy, pretty straightforward. We want to buy protection, buy insurance against a decline in the price. So we're buying a put option on that spot Bitcoin ETF. That put is probably going to be reasonably expensive, especially given the vol in Bitcoin. And therefore, we need to pay for it somehow. We don't typically advise folks paying for it with cash. Rather, we'd rather pay for it with sort of foregone potential upside, and that's by selling a call. So your collar is buy a put, sell a call, and do that in a way that is sort of slightly net positive from a cash flow perspective. You can take up to 70% of your risk off the table without selling any. And so that's a move we do for a lot of folks with concentrated stock positions today. We don't view Bitcoin ETFs any differently.
What would you anticipate in terms of kind of a typical return then off of this kind of investment? Because obviously for those who are looking to play the swings, they're not going to have that advantage to the upside, but they're also going to be immune from most of the downside as well in terms of the swings that we see on spot Bitcoin. So what kind of returns are you thinking about off of this strategy?
I'd really redirect that to thinking about what kind of volatility reduction are we going to see. And again, that's typically taken up to 70% off. For the tactical folks who enjoy trading it, it is a tool you can use to mitigate risk for a time period without selling, and then take it off to sort of reestablish your overall position and participate in the upside. But for other folks where it's been such a long-term winner for them, this might just be a way to take chips off the table without having to pay taxes.
All right. I get it. Because when you said it, you've got kind of a high fee on it, I was just trying to kind of figure out in terms of what we could expect in terms of returns off of it.
Hey, Dave, I want to take a step back and just talk a little bit about SpiderRock Advisors, because on your website, you do say that derivatives have a place in almost all portfolios, with volatility as an asset class serving as a core holding. I'll be honest, it's not something that we talk about a lot when it comes to an individual's portfolio, but I don't think a lot of people have derivatives apart from, you know, ETFs in their portfolios. So why do you think derivatives have a place in everyone's portfolio?
Especially for the taxable investor, listed options can help in a number of ways. It's really the only way to change your risk profile without having to sell your existing underlying holdings, which of course triggers a tax bill, permanent drag on performance. So reshaping risk, whether it's through too much risk in single names that you've owned that have had great rallies, a few stories on those even this week, to just lowering your overall beta exposure, to creating additional cash flows through call selling or put selling. There are all kinds of different tools you've got available with the listed option market with respect to a typical wealth management portfolio, stocks, bonds, funds. And through our technology and our business, you know, our goal is to bring a lot of customization to that and help folks achieve the changes they want to make in their portfolio using options, because they're the only way you can deliver some of these solutions. Maximizing after tax is the real goal.
No, it's an important aspect, certainly, of this strategy. Hey, Dave, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Dave Donnelly, he's managing director at SpiderRock Advisors, as we said, a Chicago-based asset management firm, and they've got about $4.5 billion in assets under management. But this makes sense, like coming off of the spot Bitcoin ETFs that we've seen approved, like everybody's trying to figure out the strategies off of it, and, you know, minimizing volatility through options obviously makes a lot of sense.
Yeah,
or it's going to be certainly something that we knew was coming.
Have to wait for those regulators to give the nod of approval.
Yeah, absolutely. Not yet, but you would assume that, right? They're going to allow for kind of an expansion of some of these trading strategies.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline, it's teamwork, and it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
Hey, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
You drive me crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
TikTok, everybody. 18 minutes left
you
in today's trading
go ahead
session.
And say that.
I know, I'm not a good rounder. We're definitely off our best levels of the session. As you heard Charlie break it down, slight gains on the S&P and Dow, NASDAQ lower. Feel like a little bit of a break, a pause, if you will, from the NVIDIA rally that was yesterday. But S&P, what? We're still at a record, right? Doesn't matter what
we
it moves.
We just got to be in the green. And Carol, we're in the green right now.
Up 5 points.
Exactly. Hey, let's see what Caterina Simonetti has to say about this. She's Senior Vice President and Private Wealth Advisor at Morgan Stanley Private Wealth Management. She joins us on Zoom from Philadelphia. Caterina, how are you?
Thank you for having me on the show.
Yeah, it's good.
It's good to be here on the Friday.
It's good to have you back with us. What a week it was. Help us make sense of the gain that we've seen in the S&P 500 so far this year, in the NASDAQ so far this year, when, you know, we're talking already up 6.6% in the NASDAQ, 6.8% in the S&P 500. What's left for the year?
Well, what an incredible start of the year. And when you kind of think about the transition that we finished 2023 with this focus on what Fed is going to do, and then we went into January with this wide expectation that we're going to have, you know, 5 rate cuts. And what we're seeing now are these earnings surprises. And they're not just surprises across the board. They're surprises specifically in the names, the Magnificent Seven names that, you know, have done so well. You know, so now it's going to be progressively difficult for the Fed to be very aggressive with rate cuts. And consensus now is that we're going to have, you know, about 3 of them. And the focus for investors is really on these fast-moving stocks. And what we're seeing as the biggest trap to try to avoid is when investors are starting to doubt their diversified portfolios, starting to doubt asset allocation, and are kind of saying, like, should we stay with blue chip stocks? Should we stay diversified? Or should we switch direction into this highest growing stocks? And that's what, you know, these are the type of conversations that we're having, you know, at the beginning of this year.
Well, having said that, we kicked off earlier with our Gina Martin Adams, our chief equity strategist here at Bloomberg Intelligence. And she said, you know, with all of the interest and mania surrounding NVIDIA and our obsession with technology, that she said more stocks in industrials and financials made more highs than tech over, I think she said, the past week or so, which was kind of interesting. And that's why she said she was finding it constructive for investors to look specifically at those spaces. How are you seeing it? Could you drill down a little bit more specifically in terms of where you think, not just a broadening out, where investors should be maybe adding some more in terms of asset allocation?
Absolutely. And I want to be clear that we are not advocating giving up on tech, because tech is playing an absolutely instrumental role in the growth of the sectors like industrials and financials and healthcare. And we are seeing some of these companies all across the sectors, you know, making significant investments in AI, in increasing profitability, in cutting costs. And technology is going to play an absolutely essential role there. So technology should be in the portfolios, but we're seeing the other sectors like financials, industrials, with this, you know, huge government spending in that space, with healthcare. You know, we have aging population and the need for healthcare services is becoming more and more. I mean, there are exciting developments with genomics and biotech. So we see the opportunities across the board. We're advocating looking at valuations. What we are cautioning investors not to do is when we are looking at earnings, and especially the earnings that are so exciting and are looking, you know, very good, you know, the question is, how sustainable are they? And there is no such thing as growth in perpetuity, right? Like, so the reason that we diversify.
And yet, don't you feel like constantly there's a pushback against the Magnificent Seven, those growth names? And yet here we are year after year focusing on them and talking about them, and they continue to lead the market gains.
Absolutely. So I think the real question we should be asking is, what should we do about it? And investors that don't own those names and really want to own them, there is no, you know, we're not telling them don't own them. The question is how much. What we are cautioning them from is abandoning healthcare and financials and industrials, instead of just going and focusing and concentrating in these individual names, but taking a reasonable position, because you want to be part of that AI story and want to be part of that growth, and you don't want to feel like you're missing out. That's perfectly acceptable. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm. So I guess the question I have is really about the macro environment. And it does, you know, politics notwithstanding here and the election notwithstanding here in the U.S., what kind of derails the path that we're on right now? Because it does seem like so many economic signs that we're getting, so much of the data, it's seeming pretty good.
Absolutely. And I think that, Tim, the economic data that we need to look at more than at any other area is the labor market, because the data that we're seeing from the labor market is extremely mixed. On one side, we have full employment, we're seeing high wages, but we're also seeing this waves of layoffs, or, you know, the cost-cutting projections that include the possibility of the layoffs. And as of right now, you know, the consumer confidence and willingness of consumers to spend and their optimism about the market is something that is playing a very big role. It's this huge tailwind, you know, for the growth of the economy. But if we're going to start seeing this shift and the change in the labor market, that is something that is going to be pretty pivotal, you know, with the slowdown of the economy, and something that Fed is playing a very close attention to when it comes to the decision on the timing. Yeah. With the amount of rate cuts.
Carol, this is exactly what Gina Martin Adams said earlier today. Watch the labor market. It just doesn't seem like we're getting any signals that there's weakness there, except for, and this is kind of ironic, the tech industry layoffs that we've seen over the past 6 weeks.
And she said if we do start to see overall the labor market start to roll over, and that the Fed does feel like it needs to cut rates sooner rather than later, I mean, that could be problematic, that the economy is slowing down, and that ultimately will lead to slower earnings growth. Like, it all relates back. And then you have to start rethinking about valuations on the equity side of things, potentially.
Potentially.
Okay. All right. Katerina Simonetti, she's Senior Vice President and Private Wealth Advisor at Morgan Stanley Private Wealth Management, joining us from Philadelphia.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
What could you do if your data was working for you and not against you? With Bloomberg delivering enterprise data directly to your systems, you get easy access to the details you want, optimized for higher level analysis, and financial data experts committed to helping you maximize your every move. Our data is made for more, so you can show the world what you're made of. Visit Bloomberg.com/enterprise data to learn more.